I think when we began this whole business of the ecumenical movement, we said the word ecumenical over the centuries until relatively modern times had meant general, universal, and particularly as relative to a council of the church. Meaning, therefore, that historically, there had been, until this present council, 20 general councils of the Catholic Church, which meant, as far as possible, all the bishops of the Catholic Church met. That's a good, rough, homemade definition of a general council. As many bishops of the Catholic Church as you can get to come. Now, they're under orders. Nevertheless, they are human. They may have human failings, among which could be physical ones. It would be just too difficult. Or the emergency situations back in their diocese, which would make it impossible. Or in olden times, the whole difficulty of travel. There's no excuse in modern times on that score. These councils from Nicaea, one, usually when we hear the word Nicaea, we think there was only one council of Nicaea. No, there were more than one. But the councils of the Catholic Church are designated in two ways, by number from 1 to 21, and that's where we are now, the 21st, or by name. And the name is the locale, the city where the council is met. And if the same city comes up again, then it is Nicaea 1, Nicaea 2, Constantinople 1, Constantinople 2, Vatican 1, Vatican 2. You'd see, well, isn't every council, general council of the Church of Vatican Council? No. Because while St. Peter's has been on Vatican Hill for a long time, to be exact, since the time of Constantine, nevertheless, not all the meetings of the general council of the Church have been held in Rome. Obviously, Nicaea, Ephesus, Chalcedon. And even if held in Rome, some were held in the Lateran, which is just a good 25-minute brisk walk from the Vatican to the Lateran. Yet they give it a different name, although both are in Rome. Vatican and Lateran are both in Rome. I was standing once in front of the Lateran, having just come out during the Holy Year 1950, and a very American-looking tourist turned out to be an attaché to the American Embassy to Afghanistan by the name of Daniel O'Connell. And in his very best, which was very poor Italian, he asked me, where is the Lateran Basilica? And in good American, I said, you're standing in front of it. Well, the Lateran is a place where councils of the church have been held. The first Vatican Council was held in 1869 and 70. This is called Second Vatican, although for some time, I am told, Pope John debated whether he shouldn't simply call it second installment of Vatican I, but it would look like an afterthought, so he decided to call it Vatican II. So we've got a brand new council, Vatican II. What is an ecumenical council? As we said, it is, membership-wise, a meeting of all the, as far as possible, all the bishops. Notice it is bishops. As successors of the apostles, they are the ones who make the council. But the purpose of their meeting is clearly not just to get along, to get to know each other, and it helps. Bishops have told me they've learned a lot about their fellow bishops. And corresponding with a man for years, it makes a difference to meet him. But to deliberate on questions that are not only timely, but critical. Now, while that element or the adjective critical or crucial has been somewhat softened as regarding the Second Vatican Council, nevertheless, it is dealing with critical and crucial issues. And all you've got to do is read what's happening, and you know they are critical issues. As is obvious, given only 21 in 19 centuries, their average is a little less than 1 per 100 years. So they don't meet often. Now, before we go any further, something has to be said. It would seem, ostensibly, that if the Pope is infallible, and the Pope minus the bishops, in other words, he does not have to consult the bishops or get their approval, why bother having a council? That's a good question. And one big reason, by the way, why Pope John had, so his own memoirs indicate, for summoning the Second Vatican, was to disprove the theory, the idea, that a pope, although absolutely speaking, is infallible without the bishops. In practice, he doesn't run the church without the bishops. He needs the bishops. And the one big thing that Pope John wanted to prove by the council was the church needs the bishops. Now, why summon the council? Because this is the first one since the business of papal infallibility was defined. It might be almost called a kind of a balance to Vatican I. So that while Vatican I decided on papal infallibility, Vatican II, among other things, according to Pope John's desires, is to prove to the Church not the infallibility of individual bishops, but the indispensability. If the Pope is infallible, the bishops are indispensable. An ecumenical council, therefore, deals with crucial issues and does not merely discuss or even deliberate. It decides. And in this sense, the meeting of the Vatican Council is quite different from, say, the Lambeth Conferences of the Anglican hierarchy, which meets around every 10 years at Lambeth Palace in London under the aegis of the Archbishop of Canterbury and discusses a lot of things and does put out a report. But that's all it is. It's just a Lambeth report. No Anglican bishop would believe himself to be bound in conscience to follow that report, as I've been told by several Anglican bishops. Well, how does the council operate? We are now talking about the Second Vatican Council because changes, as you can imagine, have come into existence over the centuries, and we can hardly expect Nicaea I back in 325 to have operated the way Vatican II in 1964 operates in our electronic age. Yet this has been pretty much the pattern of modern councils, even Trent, certainly First Vatican, and most surely Vatican II. There are two stages, one before the actual meeting, one once the meetings have begun. And in a sense, the biggest job is finished before the council actually organizes, at least before it meets. What I mean is to decide on what's going to be worked on, who's going to do the job, to set the rules of debate, and really, what are you after? The bishops do the decision, but the conditions of their deciding are settled before the council meets. There are four levels to the council's operation before its actual session. At least there have been such before the Second Vatican. Now, these each have subsidiary functions. We don't want to belabor this point because we have a lot to see, especially as referable to the ecumenical movement. On the other hand, I think it is a considerable moment to get some taste of Catholicism in operation, at its biggest, and to see that it does have an authoritarian structure which, of course, other churches don't have, and to see how differently the Vatican Council operates from, say, the World Council of Churches, by contrast at least, and how now that they are coming to see and meet each other, see, what kind of gives are necessary, at least what might be conjectured. The first is convocation. That must be done by the Pope. Pope John had to convoke the council officially. Now, he talked about it. You can hardly imagine, this is a good description of Pope John, you can hardly imagine him keeping a secret. Even to himself. So, I suppose, we don't know how soon after he got the idea to have a council. in the next conversation with somebody, he told them what he was thinking about. See? Well, you can imagine, that got into the papers and became public knowledge. But it took quite some time, from the time that he got the idea to the time that he really worked it out. And Pope John was not the organization genius. See? He was charismatic, but his charisma did not extend to being a great organizer. Anyhow, Pope John had officially to convoke the council. Between the convocation and confirmation stands the papal authority. Without convocation, no council meets. Without confirmation, no council decides. Now this is Catholicism at its simplest. You notice how different from the World Council of Churches. Now, should even, for example, a council have started, minus the Pope, as there have been over the centuries? Somewhere along the line, the Pope had to decide, I guess it's a pretty good council, let's go along with it. If he doesn't, in the eyes of the Catholic Church, there is no general council. And less still unless there is a confirmation. After the convocation and the mechanics of deciding what this council is going to do, so we're going to have a big meeting of the bishop. So what are they going to do? The decision on what they were going to do was up to the Pope. And for that, then, he appointed a series of commissions. Now, I have here, among regular news that I was getting via my theologate from Rome, came out every week at the council, and even during the summer months, I get a blow-by-blow, sometimes it's almost blow by blow report, see, on who's there, what they're saying, and what are they thinking sometimes. Well, here were the commissions that were organized. The Theological Commission, Commission of Bishops and Diocesan Government, Commission for the Discipline of the Clergy and the Faithful, that's right, of the clergy too and the faithful, Commission of Religious, that is, of men and women belonging to religious orders, Commission on the Sacraments, on the Sacred Liturgy, on Seminaries, on Universities, on Eastern Churches, on the Missions, on the Lay Apostolate, on Media of Communication, and finally on Christian Unity. I think there were 12, I didn't count. Those commissions then began to divide their work. In other words, the Commission on Missions had to do with the business of evangelism, especially in countries outside of a home base. Those having to do with religious had to study those problems, and the sacraments, those problems. Over each of them was appointed a secretary in charge, and the commission itself was put into the hands of, or under the aegis of, a cardinal, who was, you might say, the ultimate authority, although he did not directly run the commission. At the council, he is responsible for it. But during this preparatory stage, and even since, of course, the experts, the scholars behind it. Among the commissions, the most important was the theological, the one having to do roughly with faith and order, corresponding, you see, to the World Council of Churches, here having to do with the doctrine of the Catholic Church. The secretary of that commission, the head of it, in other words, is my former teacher, thesis director, my friend and correspondent, Sebastian Tromp, T-R-O-M-P, a Dutchman with all of the wonderful and perhaps sometimes limiting qualities of the Dutch. There is no danger of any heresy creeping into the Second Vatican Council while he's alive. These commissions, of course, were appointed, but they're supposed to do something. Now, here's where the democracy of the Catholic Church comes into play. And this, by the way, I'd say overshadows even the democracy of a World Council of Churches. This is Catholicism on its democratic best. The commissions were appointed, but what are they going to commit? Immediately and simultaneously with the commissions being organized, the Vatican wrote to all the bishops of the Catholic Church and to all the schools of theology. That is where theology is taught professionally. They were given a time limit. It is approximately 6 months to discuss, work over, and decide on what things they thought should be discussed and decided upon by the council. Now notice, not one thing was added by the Pope except what was recommended by the Church at large. Nothing else. And in the meantime, the opinions and the judgments and the aspirations and attitudes of the people were canvassed and were reflected, because I worked on the commission for quite some time in organizing these postulata. Now, I thought I'd bring along your samples. They are not for public. In fact, there's a notation on top. These are not to be read by anybody else. One from Europe, or two from Europe, and one from the United States. This one happens to be the one that I worked on. This one happens to be, these two happen to be from Europe, which we got from, and we exchanged, as we were working on these, the various schools of theology and bishops, exchange. What are you working on? How are you going to propose your question, your case? In each case, specialists in different fields were told to think things over, have meetings, then to come to some kind of an agreement on what would be submitted to Rome for the council to work on. And it was not just a bare statement. We want some decision on, say, on marriage. Some decision on marriage. Marriage is a big subject. So, specifically, down to the minutest details, then, to make sure this thing wouldn't take up too much space, it was boiled down to the minimum of words. Not exactly telegram style, but relatively short. This is one of the longest. There are some that are longer, perhaps. This is fairly long, coming in four steps. In each case, a petition was made called a postulatum, and they are called postulata in the plural, something which was requested of the Vatican. And then, and this was required by Rome, why do you want this? Why do you want this discussed? Here, for example, is a request for the diaconate, the permanent diaconate, which was one of our requests for the permanent diaconate. Then, in about 100 words, all of course in good Latin, why bring this up? What's the issue? What's the situation? Why is it a critical subject? Okay. All told, to illustrate, this, for example, would approximate about 5-10. I'd see the average from each bishop was about 50, and from each school of theology about 80 postulata. The total finally amounted to, in the bound volumes that the commissions received, the total amounted to 15 bound volumes. And after the date was set, then no further requests were honored. They had plenty. They spent upwards of 2 years in Rome, these commissions, working on the postulata. And the end product they wanted to produce was the agenda. In other words, what to do? What's the council going to do? If they gave each of the bishops 15 volumes, and told them to, now let's get together, you can imagine what would have happened. Nothing would have happened. So they boiled them down, first of all kinds of overlappings, as you can imagine, see? The frequency, notice, the frequency of a request was the first criterion. The frequency of request. Then another criterion, besides frequency, was, of course, the persons requesting, the stature of the persons requesting. And thirdly, an evaluation on the basis of the reasons they gave, so that even though in some cases not too many requested, if the reasons they gave were such as suggested urgency and a crisis, something which demands attention, they were put on the agenda. Now, between the agenda and the schemata is already the beginning of the council. Once they get the agenda together, they boil them down according to sections. For example, the schemata, by the way, is the Latin word for outlines. The singular is schema, the plural is schemata. It means an outline. In other words, a summary. Call them summaries. Now, the summaries were made out of the agenda, but the schemata are the things that are used by the bishops. See? That's what they're working with now. They were drawn up before the council met. Now, you see immediately the great power of these commissions. Because if you don't get, if your idea, your issues don't get into the schemata, it may have been a very good idea, but the council just won't work on it. Now, the commissions had been meeting with the Pope regularly, so that he was, as it were, hovering over this thing constantly. He was meeting in regular sessions, sometimes daily, with the secretaries of these commissions. At any rate, when the council was ready for its first session, certain schemata were already drawn up. What is the shape of these schemata? They are, well, they're really more than outlines. The word outline is misleading. It's an English translation of the word, and it's really incorrect. It is really a condensed declaration of the Church, which the Council proposes for approval by the Pope, which contains three sections. Each schemata has first the introductory section, which you might say explains why bring this up, what are we after, so you get your bearings. Then the positive section, which is an exposition of doctrine, if it is such, namely a doctrinal thing. And thirdly, now here's where Vatican II differs. In other councils prior to the Vatican, the third part of each schemata was always a series of condemnations, of anathemas. After the positive doctrine had been stated, then came the canons, as they were called, the anathemas. If anyone says, it's always the opposite of what was stated in the positive, anathema sit, let him be anathema. In other words, he's no good, he's not with us, we're against him. Now, Pope John requested, and it seems almost certain that no matter how long the council convenes, true to his spirit, although the Pope, of course, may change Pope John's ideas, it seems that the so-called canons, which state the negative position and condemn those who teach the opposite, see, will not appear in Second Vatican. But the third part will be a series of decrees, if called for, see, implementing in practice, see, the doctrine previously stated. See? So instead of canons, decrees. Now these, by the way, these decrees have also been held in other councils. What I'm saying is that the Second Vatican, where it does implement, as it may well have to implement, see, the positions which are doctrinal or matters of principle, or what do you do about it? What are the directives? And the council, of course, won't forbear saying what should be done. The decree element, therefore, would be the third part. And that's the shape. That's the way they are formed already. Well, what more has the council got to do? Well, a lot. Because it has assembled schemata, or schema, see on the Church. Goes on for pages. Which contain, say, these three parts. Yet that is given to the bishops, and summaries of those were given to the bishops, summaries of summaries, before they're coming to Rome, so they could know what to expect. In the actual sessions of the council, the purpose of the council is to work on those schemata. That's the only job it's got. Now, each schema has all kinds of, you can imagine, supporting literature. See? It has its own footnotes. And those footnotes may be a library. But the hardcore of the work of the council is to go over this thing, change, add, remove, or even completely, as in one case, scuttle. And when it does that, then you have a conflict, as occurred on one dramatic occasion, see, between the commissions and the bishops. It occurred on November the 20th, in fact. After the first session of the council, and was the crucial test, you might say, of the council's position. What authority do the bishops really have? In other words, do they have to take the schema? And talk about flexing their episcopal muscles. It was not enough. Actually, they did vote. There were enough to vote to accept the schema. See? But Pope John, seeing what was happening, figured there are too many bishops, see, who don't like it. Let's ask for another schema. At any rate, that's the function. Then come the discussions and deliberations, all kinds of rules. How long they may talk, and so on. And of course, it has to be on the subject, it has to be to the point. They have a series of experts whom they can consult, the bishops. Strictly speaking, the only ones who have a right to the floor are the bishops. The bishops and the heads of religious orders of men. It's just a prejudice, I'm sure, but there it is. Then the vote. Vote on what? Vote is always on the schema. Okay? Now, of course, the vote need not be only on the whole finished product. Okay? There are all kinds of, you might see, subsidiary votes. They want to change a paragraph. Instead of if, they want to make it when. Okay, they want to change the if to when. So they have not a showing of hands, but they have electronic devices. Well, the whole thing in a matter of seconds. See? Talk about being up to date. They just push a button, and the thing shows up. And they can just count the buttons. In fact, I think they have an electronic device to count the number of buttons. I think it's red against. I'm not too sure. And green is for. Anyhow, the electronic devices expedite the voting, and they can do a lot of voting in a short time. All they've got to do is make up their minds.
Well, may I ask that discussion? I thought I read somewhere that the discussions conducted in Latin.
The discussions on the floor of the council are conducted in Latin. Although there are all kinds of discussions in the committees, which I'm sure will be in the vernacular.
These committees,
meetings,
are the bishops appointed by some central authority on which particular committee?
Yes, they are. They are appointed by the Pope. And I have, to illustrate, for example, I have the list of the United States bishops who are working on the commissions. See, not every bishop gets on the commission. They have all commissions and no councils. So. But there are 18 American bishops that work on the commissions. Just to illustrate, Bishop Alter of Cincinnati on the bishops and diocesan government. Bishop Cousins of Milwaukee on the laity. Daly of Des Moines on religious orders. Dearden of Detroit on theology. McIntaggart of Brooklyn on Oriental churches, and so on. Bishop Wright of Pittsburgh on theology. Sheen, Bishop Sheen of New York, on missions, as you would expect.
In between the legs. Now, for example, Archbishop Dearden and I think Bishop Babcock on the communication media. Do they have meetings with people in the area, or
do they
have meetings with people in the United States that are not in their own diocese?
Oh, also. In other words, they have ample room. They don't meet that often, or at such length, they don't have plenty of time for that. They do. And in fact, Rome is just filled with people from all over the world, see, who are there ready to give their advice. And, pardon me, I didn't mean it as a majority, they're just happy to be of assistance. Then the vote, in general, a 2/3 majority, and to to indicate how the voting goes on certain subjects, this will just illustrate the vote was on the preface, the introduction to the decree on the liturgy, which has already been passed by the Vatican Council. In other words, after a lot of discussion and whatnot, now, are you satisfied? Is it all right? Do you want more changes? Or is this the last vote on the introductory section on the preface? Well, they had four paragraphs, and they voted separately on each paragraph. They leave nothing to the imagination. And the votes were close, but not quite. The number of voters, and this suggests that some of the bishops must have absented themselves, because on the first paragraph, there were 2,206 voted, and on the fourth paragraph, only 2,204. Anyhow, required for majority in all cases, was about 1,500. If 1,500 voted, that would be enough to have the thing passed. The actual vote, for example, on the first paragraph was 2,181 against 14, and weren't sure, 11. You know, it was a thing passed. That's as close to unanimity as you can get. And by the way, the complete spread for the four paragraphs with 2,200 required was always short, affirmative, of 2,200, about 2,180 each time. See? And there's no pressure, no duress. See? So this, of course, is after a great deal of discussion and whatnot. But even though they vote with such practical unanimity, it is not yet law in the Catholic Church until the Pope confirms. And the committee, or the schema, they call it the decree on the liturgy, has been passed and was, I think, December the 10th or 12th, I forget the exact date, of 1963, which is now law of the Catholic Church, with monumental changes in the offing, especially the giving of bishops freedom to do things, as we will see, I trust, before the class is over. We're going to 10:30, I hope. Have you not? Good. Oh, I'm afraid of that clock. Now the planned agenda. What did he originally plan to work on? Which plans have been somewhat modified, mainly because of being, you might say, stuck in certain areas and just being there. The whole area and many others may yet be treated, but these were the main areas. Now, frankly, no one really knows, except the committee working at the Council directly, just exactly what are the main areas which the Vatican Council finally wants to work on. My informants from Rome were those who were fairly close to the Vatican. I trust their judgment, and it's as far as I can go. Anyhow, they gave me names. This was back before the Council began to meet, and things are working out pretty much in this pattern. About seven areas with subdivisions. The area of Scripture which hasn't been touched yet. And as you know, there are many crucial problems arising in the field of the Scriptures. Interpretation, the whole new theology or new biblical theology which is opening up. How far does a Catholic go? How far may he go? What does it mean? And so on and so forth. It can be said, however, that if this is being treated, if it will be treated, it will not give its sanction to some of the extremes, and there have been extremes in Catholic biblical writing. How do we know that? From at least two things. From two documents from Rome, one under Pope John, surprisingly, the other under Pope Paul, recently. So both cautioning, warning Catholic biblical scholars to, of course, be as up-to-date as possible, but to remember they've got basic truths to preserve. The latest thing, by the way, I haven't seen the Italian yet, I just saw this. resume and a paragraph or two from Cardinal Bea, who is in charge of the Committee on Christian Unity, fine article that he wrote in Rome, see, lining out the rules that he thinks Catholics and Protestants ought to observe in their studying the scriptures together. See? And be it said, those rules are very conservative, which I think will give evangelical Protestants a great deal of hope, who sometimes accuse Catholics of being less concerned for the doctrine in scriptures than they, the Protestants, are. Anyhow, this has not yet been touched by the Council. It is, however, supposed to be, at least eventually, depending on how long the Council lasts. The second is the Church. Now this has already been undertaken, is being discussed, is the crucial, the single biggest problem outside of Christian unity, and in fact, it is part of the subject of Christian unity, is the Church. Under what conditions does a person belong to the Church? What is the relationship of the Church to its members, within the Church of the hierarchy, to the priests, of the priests, to the laity? The whole ambit of ecclesiology is being re-examined. And it is, if I may insert just a comment or two, Catholics especially are being subject to a very heavy diet of all kinds of bizarre notions, which are publicized often without any qualification in both the public and the religious press. And the thing is to keep your fingers well crossed, see, to read and to think, and once in a while to smile and to say, we are living in times of great change indeed, but never of substantial changes to undermine the faith. Anyhow, a lot of bizarre ideas have been expressed, for example, even by the bishops on the floor of the Vatican Council, which, for anybody who is a specialist in theology, and not all bishops are, is simply not Catholic doctrine. Can't be. It isn't. Just to know that a lot of ideas are being broadcast, as it should be. And the very freedom which the Church gives her prelates and her people indicates her desire to really find out what is the truth. Third, canon law. Talking to a bishop who came from a visit with Pope John shortly after the convocation of the Council, he said this was the first reason that Pope John had for summoning the Council. The old canon law, which is not so old, but still old by modern standards, was formulated in 1918. At least it was promulgated in 1918. 50 years is not a long time, but 50 years in modern times is a very long time. See? And the result has been the so-called Codex of Canon Law, which is a summary of basic laws, over 2,000 of them, has had to be interpreted and reinterpreted to the point of certain laws being completely revised, changed entirely. See? Just to take one subject which I may have mentioned, I don't know if I did in this case, the whole idea of the parish. Did we talk about this? The nature of the parish, the nature of the diocese. See? With mobility of modern population, especially in industrial countries like America, see? The Church just cannot go on, see, with this static, medieval, territorial concept of a diocese and a parish, see, and hope to serve its people. Can't be done. Young people, say, for example, here at Western, want to get married. Graduate seniors, that is, people graduating, several of my students, who want to get married. Their parish priests are perfect strangers to them. Complete strangers. Then, they don't know much about the regulations. They decide, well, this I think will illustrate it, it's a footnote, but anyhow, let's have some footnotes. One of my students in my class, last year, a Catholic girl, she was getting married this summer, graduated, and she decided to get married on a certain Saturday in August. And on thinking, she decided, it must be the third Saturday in August. First, second, third, must be. Without looking at the calendar, made all arrangements, and went to the parish priest, could she get married on the third Saturday of August? He looked at the calendar. Did you notice? He says, that's the 15th of August. She didn't notice, but either she said or she thought, so what? Well, he told her, in this diocese, there are no marriages solemnized on the 15th of August, which for Catholics is a holy day of obligation. Well, she was so out of touch, you might say, with let's call it parochial reality, it never occurred to her. So, well, then she put in a plea, and maybe she shed a tear or two, but he was not going to be moved. So she called her father. The father went to see the parish priest, and then, of course, that made matters worse. So there she was, and she just decided, maybe she shouldn't have, but she was going to have that marriage if at all humanly possible. So she said, could you do something? What could I do? Well, anyhow, to make a long story short, she's getting married on the 15th of August. But all kinds of, you might say, representations had to be made, and so on. You see what I mean? The whole involvement of the people in a parochial life, which involves a territorial limitation, that for a lot of Americans at least, is not realistic. So canon law to study every conceivable area. Now what it's going to do, so I'm told, is to outline the broad areas of change, then to appoint a commission, set a time limit, and tell them you revise the law. Fourth, church and state. This is fast becoming the most crucial area of the Second Vatican Council. And the problem facing the Catholic Church was twofold. First, for Catholics in countries under communist domination, how far can you cooperate with the state? May you hold office? Can you imagine? I mean, all the conscience problems arising. See? Here you are, say, a public official. You are told to promulgate a given law. You don't believe the law is good. In fact, you think it's anti-religious or anti-Christian. How far can you go along with it? See? And secondly, in countries that are at least nominally Catholic, what should be the attitude of that government toward the minorities who are not Catholic? Both are Catholic problems, and both, you can imagine, need a lot of careful screening. Fifth, Christian unity. Let's save that for, I'll just mention it. We're going to talk a lot about it. This was one of Pope John's main reasons for summoning the Council. Some of his statements seem to indicate this was the first reason that he had, at least chronologically. And the reason behind his giving that as a reason is undoubtedly the fact that most of his lifetime he spent in not Catholic territories, dealing with officials, civilians, and governments that are either Orthodox or Protestant, coming to respect them and deciding something has to be done for the betterment of both sides to improve Christian unity. The laity, their role in the church, and especially whether and to what extent they have a place in the church which is not only one of expediency. Too many priests in the Catholic Church and religious, and I know what I'm talking about, consider the laity as only lay help. And too often they treat them as such. And if I were not speaking in mixed company, I would be more explicit, as I am when I am speaking to people concerned. The role of the laity as necessary for the church, as of the essence of the church, not merely on the passive, but what is most important, on the active side. And while, of course, in the last analysis, the ultimate authority to teach and administer the sacraments will be in the hands of those who are ordained. See? Nevertheless, there are vast reaches in the church, especially in the church's apostolate, which have not been touched, at least have only been mildly excavated, and need exploration and need definition. And finally, the liturgy, which of course is the worship of the Catholic Church. Vast field. And it happens that Pope John shrewdly decided, knowing human nature, in other words, he was not naive, he was not simple, he decided to start there where most people agree and where everybody will be most immediately affected, where you can see the Vatican Council in operation. And in a couple of months, when Catholics for the first time will hear the priest at the altar reciting prayers in English, they will know there are changes going on. Anyhow, the liturgy was a big field, and that is the one thing which has already been completed. My goodness, how did I time myself? We'll take up the completed areas and the current issues. Remarkable changes are first the bilingualism, which is recognized for the first time in the history of the Catholic Church, where the liturgy officially may be said in two languages, and is both Latin, say in the Latin Rite, and the vernacular. And the vernacular English in the United States will begin to be used, I'm told, before the end of the current year. Have they been having meetings, Father, in your diocese, that is in the diocese on?
They use the retreats, Father.
In retreats, on.
And I have to begin to explain it, and this is the first Sunday of Advent.
When do they, first Sunday of Advent is it going to be?
Projected.
And the changes are considerable. The actual center of the Mass, called the canon, remains in Latin. On the other hand, a great deal will be in English. But beyond that, of course, also there are changes in the administration of the sacraments. No basic change, but first the use of the vernacular, and then such things put in as to emphasize features of the liturgy that have been pretty much, if not ignored at least, omitted until now. Another main feature, and perhaps even more important on a broad scale, of the constitution of the liturgy is the adaptation to the culture of the people, which you see affects all the mission countries, which after all are the majority in the world, because although in the Catholic Church there are some 600 million people, nevertheless the vast majority of the world is not even Christian. And in countries like those of Africa, Asiatic countries, and China, Japan, India, there are already changes being made, not only changes, but even innovations, where new liturgical forms are being developed. Take, for example, the genuflection, which is so common in Catholic worship. I'm told, I think it's Japan, just recently, changed to a bow officially in the liturgy, because that is the sign of reverence in that particular culture. And it has been said that if the liturgical reform, which is now beginning to take place, it hasn't taken place yet, it's only the beginning, in the Catholic Church, if that had occurred in the 16th century, it might well have forestalled the Reformation. Certainly, many things that were complained, and I think justly complained against by the reformers, would have been changed. The Jesuits over the years have been in great difficulty until fairly recent times over their effort to adapt the liturgy and the ritual to the people of, say, China, the famous Chinese rites, which were partly instrumental to the Jesuits being suppressed, being put out of existence, because they were accused not only of heresy but of positive apostasy and idolatry. See, the distinction they made between liturgical ceremonies as such and certain signs of reverence towards a man like Confucius, which critics of the Jesuits said Confucius was worshipped as a god, therefore any sign of reverence to Confucius is idolatry, therefore no convert to Confucianism may do that, which makes sense. The whole question is, was Confucius worshipped as a god? The Jesuits, who claimed they could read the Chinese, said no. Their critics, with the Jesuits, said couldn't read Chinese, said yes. But you see, being one of them myself, I would defend the position. Nevertheless, over the years, this has caused much trouble. Now, in fact, we just say to ourselves, well, at long last.
A couple of months ago, I had a team recording about Native African Mass.
You attended the Native African Mass?
I heard it. Recording of
it. It is.
They use the drums and the Native chants.
Yes, those are.
Miss Aluba.
Yeah, they're. And it indicates, of course, the adaptation and the difficulty often that missionaries have had psychologically in shedding their own nationalisms when they go to these countries. Like, for example, my. Friend Takeuchi, a Japanese with whom I was in studies in Rome, he was a convert from Buddhism, became a Christian, and a Jesuit. We used Latin and Italian as the medium of exchange, but he told me what a big problem they had in learning Latin. Even the syllabic sounds are so different. Well, to use the language and not to have to study Latin in the musical forms. I know nothing about music, but all I tell you, it makes a difference who has the chant, whose melodies they are.
When St. Paul in the United States
to, as it were, come up to date. So, but the broad lines were already laid down, and the thing was promulgated by Paul VI, and consequently gave him something which becomes part of the doctrine. The episcopal powers, and this we're going to examine in a moment, one part has been finished, another part is still to be done. The issue is a fundamental one in Catholicism. As you know from Reformation times on, actually goes all the way back to early church times, but especially the Reformation, often the problem arose between Rome and a local bishop or bishops, say, in a given country. So much so that when you read the Reformation, it is almost like national patriotism, see, against those Italians down in a place called Italy, see, Rome, and resenting what they called encroachments on their national sovereignty. And if you read Reformation history, it's almost a pattern. So much so that you wonder how much theology had to play with it, or had to do with it, and how much nationalism had to do with it. Anyhow, over the years, and certainly since the 16th century, while the basic issue was solved, in other words, if a person is a Catholic and the bishop wants to remain in communion with Rome, he's got to remain in communion with Rome. He does not get his approval without the Pope's approval. He cannot exercise his authority unless the Pope approves, and so on. But huge tensions have arisen. And apart from tensions, because that can be overplayed by the New Yorker, for example. I read the series of articles they had on the Vatican Council. Good reading. I read that kind of reading to save myself reading the comments. I'm not being facetious. It's good, light reading. But you've got to know what's behind the scenes. All these big, crucial tensions, you know, the church is going to fall apart all of a sudden. No, it's not going to fall apart. There have been tensions, of course. But more importantly, there have been woeful inefficiency. And the inefficiency arose mainly from the fact that with a big structure like the church, with its high centrality, Rome, in other words, having the ultimate say-so on so many things, I don't say the bishops were hamstrung, but at least they were mightily handicapped to exercise that kind of freedom which they thought they should have. And of course, no single bishop could write to, say, the Pope, even to Pope John, and say, "Your Holiness, how about giving me a little more authority? I don't think I've got enough." He'd get a letter right back, and he wouldn't get more authority. Only a council could really settle a thing like this. So what has been settled? What has been settled is that in December of 63, along with the Constitution and the Liturgy, Pope Paul VI removed from his jurisdiction 40 areas of authority. And they cut across every phase of worship and practice and service. The whole question of marriage questions. While there are some that are still to be reserved for Rome, most of them can now be handled by the bishop. 40 such areas. And that in itself was worth a council, more than one bishop. Let's say. That was worth a council. Because most of them were such that no bishops had ever enjoyed before. In other words, they just don't have to have recourse to Rome for so many things. I remember, I'd like to tell this because it's so obvious and so clear, but take marriage cases. As you know, in the Catholic Church, when a couple gets married, if they were both baptized before marriage, if the contract was valid in the sense they knew what they were doing and so on, free, and if they had natural intercourse, not contraceptive, I always point out to my classes, but natural intercourse after a marriage, after the contract, that marriage is indissoluble. Well, nevertheless, marriages are either declared null and void or even dissolved by the church Suppose, in other words, either or neither party had been baptized before marriage. Okay. Then you present the case. Now, until 1963, there had been some cases that were passed judgment on by the local bishops, but they were precious few. They might examine, they might test, they might gather the documentation, but they could never really pass the ultimate decision. For that, they had a right to Rome. Well, during my studies in Rome, I remember several times, any number of times. In fact, every day I would walk into somebody's room, if I would go into people's rooms every day, who were officials working for the Vatican, specialists in, say, marriage problems. Well, I'm not exaggerating when I say I would see a pile up to a foot high of documents in heavy pedestrian Latin. And only one who is not a good Latin scholar can write long, windy Latin. Pages of it, see? And they were to study these cases, these marriage cases, and assist the Vatican in passing judgment. In the meantime, this man was teaching a full load of classes, doing counseling, directing a lot of doctorate theses, that was their main work, and getting some sleep at night. In the meantime, these several hundred, perhaps, cases were lying fallow there on the desk. So what do? They always started from the top, see? And when a new case came in, they just put it at the bottom of the pile. It might take a year, 18 months. In the meantime, one or both parties had died, and the problem was solved. But the Church and Pope John, aware of the inefficiency of having everything, well, not everything, but so many things sent to Rome, decided that something needs to be done, and Pope Paul has settled part of it. But the big question that still remains is the theoretical one that we're going to study, the current issues. And the third area that has been finished is the document on the media of communication, namely newspapers, radio, TV, and the rest. There were crucial issues. The big question there, of course, was, on the one hand, having norms set down for the viewing of these things, which in a way is perhaps less important, but more important, for the projecting and for the using of these mass media. What norms, especially what moral norms, are to be followed? Now this, if you don't know, raises a lot of big questions. On the one hand, there's a very simple question of, well, you might say, adapting religious truths to modern times so they are palatable and acceptable. But more importantly, there are big moral questions. The extent of cooperating, take for example, with any radio station. Now we Jesuits run a number of radio stations. We have one of the largest in the country, in the south, connected with Loyola University. Another one at St. Louis University, and so on. But just imagine what moral questions can arise when it's a problem of, say, if you've got the station, who may use your facilities? To what extent may you cooperate with somebody whom you disagree with on principle? And there are people who use the radio for less than, you might say, the highest noble purposes. See? Whole question of advertising. Now, I don't say that all the issues of the morality of advertising were settled by the decree. See? But at least certain basic norms have been laid down. And I don't know of any single area that needs more exploration than the morality of advertising. And I don't just mean, see, using women as eye-openers, see, to catch men's attention, to sell anything from soap to pianos. It's the whole question of ethics in what you advertise and how you advertise. Given, on the one hand, that the decree recognizes the psychological necessity, modern economy, it is admitted, couldn't subsist without a constant development of what they call producing psychological needs. See, as countries become more and more civilized, that probably isn't the right word, as they become more and more cultured, whatever that culture is, they have fewer and fewer physical needs that need to be advertised, to be sold. People know they need a pair of shoes. Well, you can tell the the side of a coin that you step on with your shoes, you know that you need a new pair. And when the clothes get threadbare or your stomach is empty, you buy food. Certain physical necessities you hardly need to advertise except a certain amount of competition on the quality of what you buy. But now a single thing like this, see, is invaluable. To recognize that modern society needs to produce psychological needs. And it's legitimate. Some question that. That modern economy couldn't go on living on physical needs. To what extent may you exploit those psychological needs, which of course then cease to be needs, except as anything psychological can be a need. Anyhow, that whole area, at least as far as norms go, has been elaborated and the document has been published, and this is finished along with the other two. So the three big things that have been completed by the Council so far have to do with the rich liturgy, the transmission of a large area of papal jurisdiction to the episcopate, and the norms for mass media of communication. No current issues. There are maybe two that I want to spend the next half an hour on. First, the theoretical question of the relationship of the bishops to Rome. Now this, as you see immediately, has grave implications for the ecumenical movement. Because if there's anything which Protestantism and Orthodoxy too, but especially Protestantism, is leery of, it is the central authoritarian nature of the Church. And the very fact that more than once, especially in conversation sometimes with people, they will even forbear in conversation, well, I try to look not offended, instead of speaking out at least the Roman Catholic Church, they don't call it Catholic Church, they will say the Roman Church. In other words, the word Rome and the adjective Roman have become symbols of authoritarianism and correspondingly as inhibitors of the human spirit. You don't have to read five pages of any polemic on the subject without realizing this is it. Consequently, it has great implications that if the Church is decentralizing itself, as it is, this then has opportunities or offers opportunities in the ecumenical field, which have yet to be explored. But the theological issue is of a different order. Or rather, it is the underpinning of the practical side. Over the centuries of the Christian, and here the Catholic Church, there have always been two seats of authority. From the time of Peter, a Catholic would say, there had been Peter, there were the apostles. And we know that tensions can arise between the apostles and their successors, who are the bishops, and Peter and his successors, who are the popes, from the fact that even back in the apostolic age, Paul is said to have withstood Peter.